The interviews that you are about to hear were all recorded at the Unstraight Conference that took place at the Museum of Liverpool on June the 13th and 14th, 2014. My thanks to Homotopia and the Museum of Liverpool for making this possible. I found Janet Dugdale, who's the director of the Liverpool Museum. Janet, can you tell us what it means for Liverpool to host the April Ashley exhibition?
It's incredibly important for Liverpool to be able to host April Ashley Portrait of a Lady here at the Museum of Liverpool. As a Liverpool-born person, April has been kind of an extraordinary role model, I think, for trans people right across the world. So her transition is a global story. The challenges that she's faced during her life are a global story. But actually, her life history is rooted here in Liverpool. So to be able to go from that personal story to what is she's a global icon, I think, for the trans community. Really important to be able to do that here in Liverpool, and it's been a great pleasure and privilege for us to work with April, but really with Homotopia, who were the people who brought the idea to us.
Now, what sort of reaction have you had from Liverpool as a city?
Really mainly positive. We are a big city history museum with about 1 million visitors a year, so quite a family friendly museum. So some people have been challenged by having her story, but also the story of kind of gay rights, really, I suppose, in the museum. But overwhelmingly, people have really responded very well to it and really tried to understand, I think, a little bit more about legal, social, political, cultural changes for LGBTQ communities across the world. And I think it's just got more and more relevance. The exhibition's been on for 9 months at the moment. We're continuing it until December because it has been so popular. And I think it's helped people really think about some of the issues that trans people face right across the world today.
And finally, one of the things you've been promoting here is a network for museums interested in social justice issues. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, here at National Museums Liverpool, we're really kind of a value-run organisation, and one of the things we launched last year at a Museums Association conference, which was in Liverpool, was a Social Justice Alliance for Museums, which is a global network. No membership fee, no joining. If you're interested in it, look up SJAM, S-J-A-M, and you'll find us. And we're trying to bring like-minded people together who work in museums, who believe that museums have a real role in our society in terms of human rights and social justice. So get on board. So it is for museums, but it's also for other organisations who want to work with museums in either in their countries or make connections. So it's a good network.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Cheryl.
I'm Gary Everett, and I'm the director of Homotopia.
You're the organisation that put on the April Ashley exhibition, and it's your 10th year now, I believe. Can you tell me what the exhibition means to you folks?
Well, we've put this together with a lot of quite big partnerships with the Heritage Lottery Fund, with the Museum of Liverpool, and it was a sort of 5-year plan, if you like, because we first met April in 2008, and she did an event at St George's Hall when we were celebrating European Capital of Culture. And the project for us is on many, many levels. It's by far the biggest thing we've ever done. By bringing her story back to her home city was for us profound and a really important thing to do. And we worked with her very closely for the last 7 years, and she's given us an awful lot of, well, she trusts us, which is important. And for us, I think it's connected with the trans community and gender diverse community in a really important, quite epic way. And as I say in my speech before yesterday, this is the first ever HLF funded trans history project, so groundbreaking. But also for us, we had to do something quite special for our 10th anniversary, and this was it.
Now, Homotopia is primarily an arts foundation, and what you're doing here is more like history and sociology, yeah, and whatever. How has that been for you?
Well, we've diversified, and we've seen through exhibitions and visual art, it's a really great way of generating bigger audiences, generating new partnerships. And we know you can't just survive really with doing one programme of art throughout the year. We've had to rethink who we are over the last few years. And visual art exhibitions, heritage, have been a really good way of sort of helping us make that leap.
Oh, thank you very much, Gary. I've really enjoyed this conference that you guys have put on. So thank you for everything you've done.
Great, thank you.
I'm here with Bev Eyre, who is the project director for the April Ashley exhibition. Bev, can you tell us a little bit about working with April and how it was getting her cooperation to do this exhibition?
April was wonderful to work with, but I think it really helped that we got to know April for 3 or 4 years before we even had the idea for the exhibition. So by the time it came to sitting down with April and going through a personal archive, we were already friends. And I think that matters when you're sharing something so personal about your life. She went through all the archive material, which, as I said yesterday, was a suitcase full of old letters and photographs and birthday cards and bits and bobs of ribbon and all sorts of things, invitations she'd been given to places, spanning the last 50 or 60 years, and a couple of bin bags full of the same sort of material. And we sat on her floor for about four afternoons and evenings and went through them, and she talked about what the different things meant to her. And then I brought the stuff back here and had it all catalogued. Over the course of the whole project, I kept in touch with April. She came up, we went down to see her, and we kept her up to date with the designs and showed her a little bit of what it would look like, and so that she felt comfortable about it, and so when she arrived here, it wouldn't be a complete shock to her. She's an absolute joy to work with. She's a very intelligent woman. She's a very, very bright woman, and she keeps you on your toes. And if you get something wrong, she tells you. And she knows her own mind and, you know, speaks her own mind. She's great fun, great company, very, very witty, and very warm-hearted.
Do you have any particular favourites amongst the items in the exhibition?
Well, that's a hard one. In terms of April stuff, I think I like the picture of her with Peter O'Toole. She was in Spain with Peter O'Toole and Omar Sharif, and they had a couple of weeks together where they just had the most wonderful time. And she looks so happy, and they look so handsome, you know, the boys. And she used to call Peter O'Toole Cairo Fred, which... There's so many things in the archive that make you smile. I love the stories she tells about Sarah Churchill and the times that they lived together. She lived with the wicked lady who was in all the films of the Gainsborough films, Margaret Lockwood. She had a flat with her daughter. So all the celebrity stuff's nice. But what's really nice and really touching is all the little things about when she was a child in Liverpool, and she's had such a varied life. And it isn't just about celebrity with April. You know, there's something very real and heartwarming underneath it. And then in terms of the rest of the exhibition, I really love the oral histories. I was involved in taking them, and during the course of a year I met 25 people who all represented differently on the gender spectrum. And that was an absolute privilege, and every story to me I just thought was absolutely fascinating. People really start these things and say, I've got nothing to say, I've not done anything. And then, they talk about their lives, and so moving and so touching.
Oh, thank you ever so much, Bev, and thank you for putting on a wonderful exhibition.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm here with Jenny Ann Bishop, who's one of the trans people involved with the April Ashley exhibition. Jenny Ann, what's your role been here?
Well, I've taken a multitude of roles. I was approached by the team from Homotopia to give them some background in trans history. And as that's something I do regularly most years for LGBT History Month, I give a presentation on trans history. I went along and gave them a presentation that was supposed to last half an hour, and I think we've spent 2 hours looking through all the material I got. And they said, would I like to be involved in the project in terms of looking at things like the language they were using, and also helping them to recruit people for the vocal stories to go into the museum, into the exhibition. So they came along to our two groups, Unique in North Wales and Transforum in Manchester, and not only did we do some almost vox pops, as you're doing today, but we also did timelines with the girls, which were very interesting, because one of the thoughts was we might put some parallel timelines in, but that didn't happen because the designer designed that aspect out. But we got the vocal stories in. And also a number of us had our pictures in the museum. And then I also got asked, along particularly with Stephen Whittle, to look at the legal side and the university. John Moore's looked at that. So I acted as a sort of ongoing consultant. And then, as you can see at this, I did a little bit of volunteering as well. April was my hero when I was a youngster, so I was really pleased to be involved. And even so, more so to meet her again, because I met her when she came to Liverpool in, I think it was 2009, and she signed the two autobiographies I've got of her, the original one, Odyssey, and the later one, Portrait of a Lady.
That's great. And how has the exhibition gone down with the trans community in Liverpool?
It's gone down extremely well. Most people who visited it have said how good they think it is and how well it represented the community. I think we've only discovered one very tiny mistake, and they've had somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 visitors. Plenty of people to critique it, and it's really nice we've been able to add on Sarah Davidman's little exhibition about her uncle and his erasure from their family history, because obviously April and lots of us went through very similar things. So great exhibition, and it's been so successful. Instead of finishing in September, it's going to run until December.
That's wonderful. Thank you ever so much.
That's okay.
So I found Sarah Davidman, who has curated the Ken to be Destroyed exhibition here, about a relative of hers, I guess we should say aunt rather than uncle, who she discovered to be trans despite the efforts of her family to cover up this, what I presume they regarded as a shameful part of their history. Is that correct, Sarah?
Yes, that's true. And the fact that I'd been very involved in London's queer and trans communities for a long time was the only reason my mother told me about the fact that the person I'd known of as my Uncle Ken, who I now call Kay, was trans. By the time she told me, Kay was already dead. So I never knew, when I knew Kay, I never knew that Kay was trans. And when my mother told me about it, she told me I was to keep it a secret. I wasn't even to tell my brother or sister. And because of my friendships, my relationships with trans people, people who'd become very important in my life, I felt that if I was to keep this a secret, it was a betrayal of the people who'd become so important to me. And so I argued against that and made a case to my mother and tried to explain about trans politics and visibility and trans activism and how important it was to not to erase trans histories.
I know from my own experience that it is very difficult for families. So a lot of people close to you have difficulty. In fact, in many cases, the closer somebody is to you, the harder it is they find to cope with a transition. But I'm wondering that it seems it wasn't quite so hard for me as it was for Kay. Kay, of course, being an adult back in the 30s and 40s, whereas I grew up in the 60s and 70s. Do you think slowly but surely things are getting better?
I think things are definitely better now than they were in Kay's lifetime, because Kay, from teenage years, or in fact before then, from a child, knew that she was, although I don't think she would have used the word trans, but knew that she was female, I suppose. And I think it was a lot harder because growing up in what must have been the 30s, Kay got married in 1954 to my Aunt Hazel, and at that age was 39. So I don't know when Kay was growing up, my maths was never any good, but I think around the 30s. But certainly in the 50s, very, very little was known about trans people. And I think that just made it so hard, because if you feel you are this person and then the world around you reflects back to you that it's not possible to be this person, you have to be somebody else, it's an incredible pressure to try to live your life as other people would want you to be. And I do think that things are better now, in that particularly through the internet, but through so much that's happened, TV documentaries, there is a stronger awareness in society that trans people exist. They're a part of what it means to be human. And so because of that, even though there's still massive transphobia and you know, there's an awful long way to go, things are certainly better now than they were in Kay's lifetime.
Now, you're a photographic artist. What do you think people in the arts, what role do you think they have to play in raising people's consciousness about trans issues?
I think that's a very good question. And I once heard on Radio 4 a scientist talking about how he'd given up giving academic talks, and instead what he did was gave talks to the public. And he saw these talks as a way of smuggling out ideas about science. And I see my work in a very similar way. and I wish I could remember his name because I would like to credit him with the idea, but I really think that through artworks you can engage people and then you can actually smuggle out these ideas and get them to think in new ways and to question the ways that they've been thinking previously, and I think that's very, very important.
Well, thank you very much for everything that you're doing for trans people.
Oh, thank you.
I found Surat Khan, who's here on behalf of an organisation called Rainbow Jews. I know nothing about this organisation, Surat, so can you fill us in, please?
Rainbow Jews is actually a project, a Heritage Lottery funded project, and it's the first ever collection of Jewish LGBT history in the UK that just has been launched both as a touring exhibition at the London School of Economics, we'll be going around the UK shortly, and as an archive based at the London Metropolitan Archives.
Now, I have a lot of Jewish friends who are LGBT people. I guess some of them might be interested in getting involved in what you're doing. So could they contact you in some way?
Yes. So, the official project cycle, sadly, is finished. And we've had numerous people to get interviewed. But having said that, there is the archive at the London Metropolitan Archives. And there is a way of actually contributing your stories. Say, if you had the chance to record your own story and send it to the archives, I'm sure the staff there are really welcoming to LGBTQI+ people and they're happy to assist. And also there is a website which will be on for 5 years, and there is a contact form which will be checked regularly, even despite that the project officially has ended as a Heritage Lottery project. And we have quite a few volunteers who are very, very keen to accommodate as much as possible, but more or less what we're hoping that the community will step up now. We've sort of, shown the way as a sort of a pilot, and we want the legacy of Rainbow Jews to go on in Britain. So what Leicester community has done, for example, they've got a lot of Jewish LGBTQI voices there, and we couldn't quite recall all of them, but they decided to raise some money with a crowdfunding campaign across a few communities and the public, and they've already raised £800, as far as I know, from individuals and groups alike to get the exhibition over and, for example, have oral history taking events. So we'll have a few days and not 6-8 weeks where the exhibition is open for people, to record their stories, which is amazing. And I think that's how I've envisioned the future of Rainbow Jews. It's going to be a community-led project that will go on, and then hopefully we'll capture more voices, because yes, there are many, many out there, and it's by far not finished.
Are you looking for Jewish communities in other British cities to host the exhibition?
Exactly. So, Leicester will be the pilot. They're going to have it around their Pride, which is the end of August. And I think it will be a great example and case study, and for others to step up and say, I want this exhibition. I want our local community people to leave their stories with Rainbow Jews. And we want to work with archives, not just in London, but, across the country and with communities and individuals. And I think it should just go from town to town, from city to city, and work with the local museums, archives and groups.
And for the benefit of my listeners in Israel and the United States and Canada and so on, as Australia, is there any connection with the wider Jewish community?
Not for this project. It's really about Britain, about the UK community, because there really was a huge gap in history, and we felt that this group, like so many other, especially intersectional minority groups, are not officially kind of part of history. They've been sort of ignored and neglected, and I think Rainbow just wanted to make a start, to actually highlight this issue. But having said that, we are obviously in touch with, I personally go to a lot of conferences, and I'm in touch with museums, with archives, with action groups worldwide, especially obviously in Israel for the Jewish cause. In fact, I was just nominated by Haaretz, which is the biggest international, originally Israeli newspaper, English-speaking newspaper in the world, as one of the most influential new pioneers in this world. So there were 7 elected. I'm very glad to say that I'm the first and only European nominee. And although that's, I feel very chuffed about that, but I think it goes to show we need to work on faith communities stepping up. I don't want to be the only one. you know. I want people to step and say, okay, I'm a person of faith. I also have a gender identity or sexual orientation. And, you know, I can talk about it publicly. I can tell my story and I can showcase that story, you know, in whichever way. So I think we need to work together as a global community to actually raise awareness and create, not just create our history, record our history and make it accessible.
Well, congratulations on that honour being given to you, and thank you ever so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
I'm Sarah Blacksock. I'm Heritage Project Officer at Birmingham LGBT Centre, which is a centre that's funded by Big Lottery Reaching Communities and is largely a health and wellbeing centre to serve the LGBTQ community in Birmingham. Heritage and arts is one of our strands, probably about a quarter of what we do, but it's looked at in that holistic model of health and wellbeing, connecting users to various services and understanding their heritage, building self-esteem and confidence for young people. So it's part of amongst the things we do.
Now, we're here obviously talking about LGBT, diversity, inclusivity, and so on, but there are very few people of colour here, and we do hear quite a lot, particularly people complaining online, that the whiteness of the LGBT community is off-putting to people of colour. So how are you finding things?
I'm finding it incredibly inclusive, to be fair. I mean, yes, I would agree with you, there isn't much representation at the conference, but I think most of the talks and like the people I've talked to have referenced black LGBTQ artists and people. And I think that what I found with the LGBT community, who I've only really been engaged with for the last few months, is that I've been very welcomed and it's been very open. I'm aware of the issues and I know a lot of black LGBT people who in Birmingham certainly felt they couldn't integrate within the community there in the gay village and on the scene. And I would, yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because there's that thing of people in their organisation saying we're open and embracing, but what is the disconnect that stops people from engaging? And I think levels of discourse might be one of the areas of one of the barriers. And I think that there are some people, white LGBTQ people within the community, that maybe are not having the kind of deep theoretical debates that we've been having here, and so may still have some prejudices or feel that they don't need to reach out necessarily to black LGBTQ people. I'm actually what somebody defined earlier as a straight ally. And for me, it's very much a human rights issue. I say to black homophobes in the community that I know that I will never contribute or condone or inflict the oppression that my people have had and suffered over the years on any other group of people. And that has to be the bottom line across the board. So it's we've got some way to go from LGBT not being a kind of white face that people feel they can't engage with, but I'd like to be part of that kind of work in us being all on that diversity agenda and people being free to discuss and debate and not get caught up by historical prejudices or lack of understanding.
Well, clearly we're all very grateful to have people like you coming forward to make the case for, you know, people of colour who are LGBT. Is there anything specific that we as white people can do to make our communities more welcoming and accepting for people of colour?
I think having visibility and representation, I think the LGBT community working with that black LGBT community in whatever shape or form that takes, and me as a straight ally, I can advocate within my groups and networks, in my community, and a feeling of a shared struggle, really, because for me, we're all fighting oppression, we're all fighting marginalisation, we're all fighting isolation, and I think there needs to be a unity on the kind of humanist kind of platform, and I think there's more work to do, but I think if the connections that have been made over this weekend can kind of continue and build, then we might go a long way to seeing a more inclusive LGBT community.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Fürst. So it's Michael from the Berlin Schwules Museum. It's the gay museum in Berlin, the biggest one, the one and only one in the world, so as far as I know. And so I'm working there since a couple of years now, and I'm in a full-time position at the moment for 2 years, so it ends in December this year.
You talked in your presentation about how you've been changing the focus of the museum from something only concentrating on gay men to something covering the whole of the LGBT community. I'm particularly interested to know what you have in your exhibition from the Magnus Hirschfeld Institute, as that's such a key element of trans history.
It is, in a way. We have some some objects in the exhibition. For example, because it's also shown here in the Liverpool Museum, in the timeline, in the April Ashley exhibition, there's a piece on Lily Elbe. She was one of the first persons going through a whole transition with all this surgery. She wrote a book on her transition, and we do have this book and the cover of the book, and it's also in the show we have on display at the moment, and also some photographs of transgender people who were at the Institute by Magnus Hirschfeld, and he wrote these papers for them. If they wanted to undergo transition procedures, they needed this kind of paper written by Magnus Hirschfeld or other doctors. And so he did this because he was really into empowering these people those days. I mean, it's in the 1930s and before. So we do show these things, yeah.
I was hoping that more will be coming out of Germany about what the Hirschfeld Institute did because it's so pioneering.
It is, and it's really important what they did those days. And 2 years ago, we had a show that was called Trans Homo. And in this show, we tried to make a show. It was an art show with contemporary art by living transsexual people. And also Sarah Davidman was integrated in this show with her work, with her photographs. And it was mainly about the differences, but also the similarities between trans and homosexuals and what happened to them in history and what it's now. And it's because it's very interesting that there are a lot of similarities. But also, even in the time of Magnus Hirschfeld, there was already starting this kind of, I would call it kind of fighting between both sides, because you know that trans people, they were mainly called transsexuals those days, and they weren't talking about transgender, of course, but these people were, if they lived their life, they didn't really want to be considered trans, or no, sorry, they didn't want to be considered homosexuals, because this was strictly forbidden. There was this paragraph 175, and you could go to prison because of this. So the homosexuals and the transsexuals, they were kind of divided thing between those.
Well, hopefully we can learn to work together a bit better these days.
I hope so, very much, because we have to do a lot in this. We have to develop in these things a lot. Because at our museum, most of the curators are working in a freelance thing, and they're volunteering and not paid. Usually they're not paid. And so we really need people who want to show things, who have a good concept and want to show things. So we are very, very open for proposals. And if you have anything you would like to show, if you would work together with us, so feel free to contact us.
Oh, wonderful. I do hope that I'll be able to come to Berlin one day and visit your museum.
Yeah, do so.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
You're welcome.
I'm here with Dirk Denner from the Tom of Finland Foundation in Los Angeles. Dirk, welcome to the UK. How are you finding it?
Well, I love the United Kingdom, and I especially love Liverpool and Liverpoolians, if I said that right. But also, I'm loving this conference here at the Liverpool Museum. It's so reassuring and validating to have other people from all different museums and archives really coming from the same place and realizing that we're awake and we're realizing what needs to be done.
I think most of the people listening to this will know about Tom of Finland's work, but if they happen to be near Los Angeles, how can they come and visit your foundation and see it all?
Well, all they need to do is go on the web and type in tomoffinlandfoundation.org. And our address and our contact information is there. We have house tours. They just need to call and make a reservation. And we have hundreds of works of art of hundreds of artists always on exhibit on the three floors. We have events that happen there at the foundation. There's drawing classes, there are social events and film nights, and also you can resource hundreds of different artists there, and it's just a really wonderful place to come and have an experience. So if people come to Los Angeles, they should absolutely make sure that they plan, and don't leave it to the last day. Make sure you call us when you arrive so that, in fact, we can book you in a day or two after that and we're not pressured, because we also live there. And so it's some days we're not open to for tours.
I also have a lot of friends in Finland. Is any of the exhibition going to be back there anytime soon?
Well, actually, this fall, opening in September, we have an exhibition in Tampere, which is about 150 kilometers north of Helsinki, and that's going to be at the Post Museum. And in Helsinki, we have an exhibition that's going to be up for a month that is Tom of Finland's drawings that have Finnish text in them, and also there's going to be an additional exhibition of American comic artists, and that's all part of the Comic Society's festival. And that's, I think, the date it starts at the first week in September, yeah.
That's wonderful. Do you know we have a bid going to bring the World Science Fiction Convention to Helsinki sometime soon, 2017, I think?
Well, I've heard that there's a lot of actual science fiction fans in Helsinki and in Finland. And also, I want to state that going back a long time ago, that gay authors, they would actually write science fiction because there was a neutrality of sex. And so they could actually have their characters actually having same-sex relationships, and it was no big deal. And that goes back into the 40s, and that we have some records of that at our foundation.
Wonderful. Thanks very much for talking, Peter.
You're welcome.